The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
Actually, no, I think we're good. And he went, you and me are going to get along just fine.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It is writer-director George Gallo, who has a movie called Vanquish coming out in theaters April 16th. It's on digital and demand on April 20th, and it's on Blu-ray DVD on April 27th. George, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So you wrote Vanquish with Samuel Bartlett.
Yes.
I was just wondering what the inspiration for the story was.
You'd have to ask Sam. I don't have a clue. You know, he wrote the first draft and he was very gracious. He gave it to me. He said, what do you think? I said, I could absolutely destroy this for you. And, you know, I read it and it was pretty much the same premise, you know, but then I called Morgan Freeman, who's a friend of mine. I've done two other movies with him. So I said, hey, Morgan, I said, in the movie, it's a cop that's still a cop, but maybe we'll make him a retired police commissioner. And he said, great. Mm-hmm. So then we started working on the script. You know, Morgan and I talked back and forth, and then Ruby came on board. Her character was a little different in the first draft. She's maybe more of a victim, mm-hmm. you know, and we made her more of a victim/perpetrator.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, and it kind of evolved into the movie that it is.
Yeah. I was you mentioned this was your third collaboration with Morgan Freeman. Tell us the legend of Morgan Freeman.
The legend of Morgan Freeman. Well, to be honest, he's become a very good friend in the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. But you know, like the last three movies I've done, we've done mm-hmm. together. We became buddies right away. I can tell you my first experience of working with him. You know, I met him only a few days before we started shooting the first movie that I did with him. And, you know, I don't know how other filmmakers deal with stuff, but, you know, I always get jitters and butterflies, you know, before I start, and you never know what's going to go wrong. And, you know, you walk into every movie with the best of intentions, but stuff just always ends up happening. And sometimes it goes in your favor and sometimes it doesn't, you know? So anyway, I was, you know, I remember waking up early that morning, like 4 a.m. and I'm sitting on the edge of the bed and I'm like, how the hell do I direct Morgan Freeman? This guy's like this legend, you know, and who am I to tell Morgan Freeman where to stand and what to say, you know, and how to say it. But anyway, I got to the set and I remember he was my first shot of the entire movie. And he walked in and there's Morgan Freeman and he's in wardrobe. And I'm like, okay, here we go, you know, and, you know, he look, you know, if you don't know him, it could be very intimidating. Mm-hmm. And he walks up to me and he goes, all right, where do you want me to stand? And I said, well, if you don't mind, Mr. Freeman, if you could stand by the window, I'd love to get a silhouette of you. And then you could turn on this line and say that line. He went, okay. And then he went over. I said, do you want to rehearse? He said, nope, let's do it. So I went, okay. And then he went over to the window and I said, action. And we started shooting and then he did the line flawlessly in silhouette. And then he turned and then he said the line perfectly. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, and then it was over and I said, cut. And he said, any adjustments? And I said, actually, no, I think we're good. And he went, you and me are going to get along just fine. So right after that, we were like best buddies, you know? Mm. So that was pretty much, that's my working with Morgan Freeman for the first time story. That's
yeah. You exactly. said, I just called up Morgan Freeman and I was just thinking I'd love to have that life where I could just call up Morgan Freeman when I needed something.
Well, yeah. It wasn't always like this, so, you know, this I'm 65 years old. This is after a lot of years of doing this stuff and getting doors slammed in my face. And, you know, you get some good reviews and then you read how, you know, when is this guy going to die? You know, you read all kinds of lovely, you know, and anyway, so, you know, one of the perks is I get to call Morgan Freeman up, you know?
So. Absolutely.
Can you kind of give us, I guess, I don't know, a synopsis of this movie? What is this movie about? I don't want to like give away too much. So you tell us what this movie
is. I'm the worst at this. I mean, I'll do my best. It's look, these movies have been done to death, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. there's no doubt about it. And it's definitely a classic, you know, action, you know, woman has a daughter gets kidnapped, and then the woman has to do a series of errands, you know, in order to, let's you know, errands, you know, picking up money, shooting up bad guys in order to get her daughter back safely by the end of the night. So I mean, these types of things have been done many, many times, but I think what we tried to do was make it look and feel different. I mean, we were very, very cognizant there, because I love movies. So I've seen all of these movies, and I love Korean gangster movies, you know, and they're done with so much pizzazz and mm-hmm. heart, you know, and I just love those movies. And I'm like, you know, when I watch those movies, they don't seem stale to me, you know? So I kept thinking, well, let's try to find a different way in. Let's make it look different. Let's find different color palettes. Let's just try to keep it as surprising as we can. So that when it's all over, you don't feel like, okay, that's the millionth time I've seen that movie. You know what I mean? So so we try to really, really make everything count, make it different. You know, I think the fact that Morgan Freeman is in it certainly helps it a great deal, because he has such resonance and such gravitas as an actor, you know, and he's not really the person you would think to be in a movie like this. But when I called him, I said, look, I just want to have a ton of fun and do some wild chases. And you know, you'd be in a wheelchair. And he was like, oh, that sounds good. You know, I said, yeah. So this woman becomes like your mobility for the evening. And you're like, it's sort of this voyeuristic thing between you and her. And, you know, and you don't completely trust her but at the same exact time, you need each other to complete the task. So it creates a bond during the night. And he was into it. So, I mean, yeah, I think the movie is, and, you know, you guys have seen it, right? So, I mean, I think
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun, you know, and they've got great chemistry, the two of them.
Oh, yeah. They're great together. And Freeman's also playing, you were talking about keeping things different. I mean, I guess maybe he has played darker characters, but this still felt like a much different type of Morgan Freeman character, which was very cool.
I'm glad, you know, because I thought some people might think that, you know, I was trying to do the classic, you get a great actor for one day and you shoot him out and then you do everything else around them, you know, like like Morgan Freeman's on an elevator, you know, and you shoot all of his scenes in half a day, because this wasn't that, you know.
Yeah.
We really tried to, you know, I love the idea that he's like God, you know, he's like the voice, you know, in her headset through the whole movie. And anyway, we had a lot of fun. I mean, those two, Morgan and Ruby, got along great. You know, they were buddies after a couple of minutes, so it was nice to watch.
That's awesome.
I'll tell you one other thing. What's great about the two of them is, like, you know, for an actor, if you're a young actor and you're working with Morgan Freeman, he's going to intimidate you. So, like, but they both really brought it. You know, like, Ruby really, she brought everything, she brought the best that she had, and she gave it right back to him. And he was like, ooh, I like this.
Yeah, I was going to say, Ruby would intimidate me, I think, more than Morgan Freeman.
Mm-hmm. That's very funny. That's very, very funny. You know, I know what you mean. Like, because I you know, when you, before you meet these people, you think you know some part of them because you watch their work.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to expect from Ruby, you know? So, and then, but when I met her, she was just like a really nice woman, you know,
yeah,
really
that's awesome.
Friendly and sweet. How do I make this better? And tell me what you want, George. And because, like I say, Morgan and I have done other films together, there was a real familiarity between he and I. So, like, he's a cut up by nature, Morgan, and I am too. I have a hard time taking stuff too seriously.
Yeah.
I always try to remind myself that my dad had a real job. You know,
yeah.
You know, my dad was a laborer, and so was my mom. And here I am, I'm getting to make movies. You know, and so I try to keep all of that perspective when things go wrong. You know, my parents are both gone, but I can just imagine saying to my dad, I had a bad day. And he goes, you had a bad day? Mm-hmm. You and your movie stars? Really? Yeah. Where's my violin, kid?
Yeah. Because, yeah. I mean, you've been pretty consistently making, writing or directing, it seems, since what, mid-80s, I guess, early 80s?
Yeah. Since, I've been pretty blessed. I came out to California in 83 with a couple of spec scripts under my arm. And, you know, I mean, like me and 20 million other people that year, you know, and I just got lucky, you know, I was pretty persistent, you know, but I just wanted to do it. I love movies. When I tell people this, something they think I'm kidding. I didn't really do this because I wanted to see my name up in lights. Like, I don't really care about that. Just the idea that you could make a film, you know, and entertain people and make people laugh or scare the hell out of them or whatever you're trying to do. It's just a thrill. And, you know, and every time you make a film, hopefully you're getting better because I learn something on every movie I make, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's always new and fresh. You know.
What was that like, by the way? Your first screenplay was Wise Guys. And Brian De Palma yeah. wants to direct it. I mean, what?
That was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a comedy, no less.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
Well, he was. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, he was what?
Yeah, I mean, no, just, I was just in trying general.
To remember you're far what he, more interesting than I am. Go, you talk.
I was trying to. You were just saying him coming in and doing comedy. I was trying to remember what he was coming off of, and I think it was Body Heat, right? I mean, not Body Heat. Body Double, right? Was that?
Yeah, the, it was. Yeah. I believe it may have.
I think
been,
so. I think that's
which
right.
Was hysterically funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yeah, it was.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like Scarface, Body Double, Wise Guys. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why he did it, other than I know he's originally from New Jersey.
Hmm.
And so is Danny DeVito, and so is Joe Piscopo. So maybe he was like three guys from Jersey wanting to go home, you know. But I wrote that script, and, you know, I don't remember exactly how it started, but I came out to Los Angeles. I had that script with me. Some agents read it and liked it, and they put me in a room with Aaron Russo, the producer. And I was a kid. I was like 26, 27 years old. And they said they wanted to develop it. And they said, are you going to stay or are you going to go back home to New York? And I was like, no, I'll stay if you guys are going to develop it. So they, you know, I got a little apartment in Sherman Oaks and I started doing rewrites. And then Danny DeVito got involved. And then Brian De Palma, suddenly they said, Brian De Palma read your the last draft. He wants to direct the movie. And I'm like, Brian De Palma, really? Okay, listen. I mean, I wasn't in any position to argue. And I think Brian did a really good job. You know, if you think about it, he started out with comedies, you know, like Hi Mom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Greetings. I mean, he definitely has a macabre sense of humor. And then, and the movie was about murder. You know, it was about two guys that get that. So, yeah, they went off and did it. And then I suddenly was a produced screenwriter.
Yeah,
I was like, holy! I can't curse, right? I was like, holy cow!
Oh, no, yeah,
you can swear all you want.
I can say holy shit.
Yeah, man.
So I was like, holy shit! I'm a produced screenwriter. I can't. So then I wrote two other scripts back to back. You talk about life changing things. I had this really nice apartment in the Valley. I wrote Bad Boys and I wrote Midnight Run back to back. That was a good couple of years. I wish I could have figured out why I was so. Hot back then, you know, I mean, like, I don't know what made me think of those movies, but I wrote them back to back. I sold Originally, I sold Bad Boys as a spec script. I sold it to Paramount. And then Midnight Run, I also sold to Paramount originally. I sold the two of them back to back. And then I'll tell you how Midnight Run got made, if you're interested.
Yeah, I'm absolutely interested.
One of my all-time favorites.
Thank you. This is why I totally believe in God, because this is like, this should not have happened. I had the script in the car, because everything back then, everything was IBM Selectrics, you know, with my two fingers typing and the white out, you know?
Yeah.
And I had the script in the car, and I was walking out to, I had a meeting at Paramount, and that was back when you could get on the lot too, without a pass, you know. Now it's like, you got to go through sector 5 and sector 10, and they pat you down and they look under the car. Mm-hmm. You know, back then you could just drive onto the lot, you know, wander around. And you know, I forgot my car keys. I went out to the car and I forgot the car keys. I was like, ah, shit. So then I walked back to where I had my meeting. I got the keys. I said, I'm sorry. And then I'm crossing the lot and there comes Marty Brest. And I said, oh, hey, Marty. And he goes, like, who are you? And I said, George Gallo. And he goes, oh, he goes, I read your script to Bad Boys. He said, I don't want to do another cop movie. You just done Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
And so he was like the hottest director, you know, for action comedy in the world. And he goes, you got anything else? I said, yeah, I got this Bounty Hunter thing I'm working on. And he goes, Bounty Hunter? I said, yeah. He goes, is it like a Western? I said, no, there are modern day bounty hunters. And they weren't like that much in the zeitgeist then, you know? And he said, well, can I read it? I said, dude, it's like a work in progress, just like writing all over it and stuff. He goes, I don't care, I'll read it. So I said, I mean, like now? And he said, yeah. And I said, all right, send the car, I'll go get it. So I went out to the car, I gave it to him. He went in his office and closed the door. And, you know, I'm a nervous wreck, you know, because I'm working on it. And I didn't really have an ending yet. And so I went next door where Waylon Green, you know, the screenwriter Waylon Green, Waylon wrote The Wild Bunch.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And he wrote a lot of stuff. Great guy. He became a mentor in a lot of ways, because he would say these things, you know, that I always remembered. Like one thing was, I'm sure you've heard this before, but I hadn't heard it. At the time, you know, I walked in there and he goes, hey, George, how are you? I say, hey, you know, Waylon. And he goes, I said, am I interrupting you? He goes, no, writers love interruptions. Any excuse not to work. which I totally understood right away. And then he goes, is he reading something of yours? I said, yeah, I got this script. I said, I hope he doesn't, you know, I said, I kind of borrowed a couple things from other movies. He goes, what? I says, I kind of borrowed a couple things from, he goes, wait, stop. Only amateurs borrow, professionals steal. I said, oh, okay. Well, I stole a couple of ideas from other movies. He said, that's fine. Don't worry. So anyway, so then Marty came out and he goes, this is great. I went, oh, thank you. He says, how does it end? I says, I don't know. I just know he lets him go. And he goes, all right, I wanna develop this. He goes, I love these two guys, the way they're fighting all the time. That was Midnight Run. That's how that happened. And that was a total accident.
That movie still holds up. I recently watched it again. And you look at a lot of movies, especially from that era, and there's like a lot of things that don't hold up. This one really does. I didn't see anything that really felt too super dated about it.
Other than smoking on the airplane and on the bus, right? Yeah, that's the only thing. Smoking or non-smoking, take a wild guess, you know.
That's
really the only thing I think that, plus they're on payphones, you know, there were no cell phones. But other than that, yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, I always try to be pretty cognizant of making the movie, the script or the directing, that it, I don't know how you describe it, but something about it that doesn't feel so of that moment, that it'll play sometime in the future. You know, I do think about that, because a lot of movies that I remembered from the 80s that I adored, you know, you look at them now and they're like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. This thing is like, oh, yeah.
We talk about that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Really?
No, yeah.
And everything that seems so cutting edge in terms of directing, you know, it's almost like parody now. Because I remember when you first saw some of those movies, you were like, this is the most incredibly amazing directed movie. And you know, now like Hallmark movies look like that or something, you know, that whole super, you know, so anyway, but a good story will just always hold. And hopefully I always try to make the story as compelling as I can. You know, sometimes you just, you know, you think it's better than it really is, you know, but I look, part of being a writer or a director is you have to be completely marinated in self-delusion. Why on earth? Otherwise you'd never do it. You know, you have to tell yourself this is going to be the greatest thing ever.
Yeah. Right?
Of course it's not, but you have to tell yourself that. Otherwise, why would you get out of bed to do it? You know, so you have to constantly convince yourself and push yourself, you know?
I don't know how far you were. I don't know how far in the development of Bad Boys you were, but I was curious because I'd heard in the past that Dana Carvey and John Lovitz were originally cast in that movie.
Yeah, I could tell you all of that.
Yeah.
You know, when I wrote the first draft, and then I was never really involved in it after that. I mean, the story stayed pretty much the same. It was the two guys, the woman that witnesses the murder, the whole drug heist at the beginning, which was loosely based on the French Connection.
Yeah.
Remember when they broke into the Evans locker room? Yeah. So all of that stuff was from the original screenplay. The fact that one guy was single and one guy was married, and that kind of, you know, jealousy, it probably is too strong a word, but extreme interest in the other person's, you know, social life. So all of that was in the original draft, but what ended up happening was, I think it was sold to Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, and eventually they left Paramount and they went over to Disney where they had a deal, and they were going to put the movie together, and they asked me to come back to do a rewrite, but I was either, I don't know if I was doing 29th Street or Trapped in Paradise. I was doing something and I couldn't do it. So they hired, I think Mulholland and Barry came on after me, and those guys are great too. They did Trading Places, but they did a much sillier version of my script.
Gotcha.
You know, so then Michael Bay was then attached to direct, and they did tests with Dana Carvey and John Lovitz, but it never came to fruition. And then, I remember then they came back to me again and they said they want to do it with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, that I want to take another pass at. And I was doing something else. I don't remember what I was doing. And I wanted to, but I just couldn't. I was contractually doing something else. And then it became the movie that we all know. Now there's four of them.
Yeah. That's one of those though. Like, I'm sure it's better with Smith and Lawrence, but I really want to see that Dana Carvey and John Lovitz movie kind of like this.
Well, you know, I ended up kind of doing that movie. You know,
That's true. You
know, yeah. Which,
cause they were both Trapped in Paradise, right?
Yes, they were. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, that was a whole other crazy experience. Cause originally we were talking to Robert De Niro and Ray Liotta. My original vision of the movie was far closer to Bad Santa, you know, which had not been made yet, you know what I mean? And I wanted to do a super gritty, tough, hard R-rated language movie about three of the most despicable people in the world that end up in this Norman Rockwell painting. Mm-hmm. And I could not convince the studio that, wait, you want to see?
Oh my God, that would have been amazing.
You want to in a Christmas movie? Are you off your rocker? And I'm like, yeah, I want to say it 1,000 times, 10,000 times. I can say whatever I want.
Yeah.
I want these three guys to just take like a big shit on Christmas, you know, and go kicking and screaming toward the light during the night, you know? And I couldn't convince them. So finally I sat down with Fox and they said, look, this goes one of two ways. Either you direct the movie the way we want the story to go, or we'll get somebody else to write and direct the movie. And I was like, well, I'd rather fuck this up on my own.
Yeah.
So I did my best to keep it. And it's, to me, it's a sillier version of the, I had a much different movie in my head, you know, that, but I that's really what I wanted to do. Like, I was talking at one point to John Turturro to play the kleptomaniac. I mean, I had a much different movie in my head. And, you know, look, am I glad I made it? I am, because a lot of people who were children back then, I appeal to children. a lot of people who were like 8 and 10 years old, that's like their favorite movie when they were a kid. So when people say to me, I love that movie, I'm always very grateful that they like it, but it's not the movie I had in my head, you know?
That was Nicolas Cage was the third person. Is that right?
Nicolas Cage was the lead brother. You know, and so then that movie got made, and I think it did okay. It wasn't like a big hit. And then after that, I just kind of kicked around. I did a lot of writing after that, you know, and I was kind of like, maybe I don't like directing. I think directing sucks. I'll just write. I'll stay home. And then after a few years, I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's very funny in Hollywood, man. You know, it's like, if you're out of the loop for a couple of years, they think you forgot how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just insane. By the way, I just directed two movies. I did 29th Street and Trapped in Paradise. Yeah, that's 2 years ago. I'm like, what do you think? I fucking forgot. I mean, like, I know where to put a camera. But anyway, so then I had a hard time getting back on the horse, you know. And I mean, you guys have questions? Am I just babbling too much?
No, you're great.
I will listen to this kind of stuff. I'll listen to stuff all day. You may have already answered my question. I was going to ask a silly question about Midnight Run, because
that said, I was on every day, so I could tell you anything you need to know.
Oh, okay. Well, it was. This is a silly question because it's one of those movies that does have the word fuck in it a lot. And I was wondering.
It was actually a question on a game show. What movie had more F-bombs, Scarface or Midnight Run? I did not know the answer. It was Scarface. But
oh, wow. I was wondering if it was in the script or if it was just the actors just letting go.
I think they threw a few in there, you know, but a lot of it was in the script. You know, I wanted to, you know, what I liked the most about writing Midnight Run, because it's happening. I don't like to fly. I don't know if you guys know. I'm a notorious flyer.
Oh, I did not know
flyer.
That.
Yeah, I've taken that. My wife and I, unfortunately, I've dragged her into this. She'll fly. She'll fly. I won't fly under gunpoint. I just won't do it. I said, just give me a fucking bullet. I'm not getting on the plane. So I've taken the train in New York dozens and dozens and dozens of times. I've driven places, you know, so I'm very aware of road trips. And I don't care. You could be a newlywed in a car. By day three, you're ready to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
Any road trip, you fucking mother. I mean, you start losing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so a lot of that to me was the humor of Midnight Run, that like adults, I don't care if they have PhDs, it doesn't matter. You get reduced to being a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
You know? And you said we were going to stop, you know, at Subway. That's what you said. You said we were going to stop. You know, you just get like, you become a child after a while. So anyway, so that to me was a lot of the humor I drew off of, you know, to write that movie.
Yeah. And it's filled with so many people who bring all that to life too. You know, I mean, aside from De Niro and Grodin, who are great in it, the Joey Pants, and you have,
Jack, don't hang up, Jack.
Yeah. And John Ashton and all these guys.
John Ashton was great.
Yeah.
Dakota, who just left us.
Oh yeah. That's right.
I'll give you a Midnight Run story. You know the scene in the coffee shop where Yaphet Kotto, where they come in and he goes, "Is this going to upset me?"
Mm-hmm.
He had a steak in front of him. I don't know if you ever noticed that.
Oh, really?
So they were cooking steaks in craft services. They kept bringing steaks out, and he'd cut the piece, and he'd go to eat, and he never ate it. So I suddenly walked in. I said, "Has anybody eaten those steaks?" There was like 8 of them. I ate like 3 of them. They were great. I was like, "Yeah, shit." I ate Yaphet Kotto's steaks. So.
You mentioned, you know, dragging your wife into this and everything, she's an actor in Vanquish. She's also an executive producer. So what is that like? What is that dynamic like, working with your wife?
My wife, working with my wife?
Yeah.
As an actor or as a producer?
Both. I mean, what's the sort of the dynamic that
it
you
sucks
have?
Sucks both ways.
I was about to say.
I can't make her look bad, because if I go back, if I go home, she's next to me. It's not like I can escape it.
Yeah.
So No, it really is terrific. We have a great working relationship. I mean, look, yeah, we've been together 37 years.
Jeez.
Congrats.
Yeah, we were kids when we met, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great about our marriage is we were kids and we were both broke. So we really came up together, you know. So that kind of, you know, there's a kind of solidness, you know what I mean, that you can't escape. You know, we know each other at our worst, at our most, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, working with her as a producer, producing, I mean, what is producing in the end? Same thing as directing or writing. It's all instincts. And Julie has, I would say, like an antenna for bullshit. And she's really, really good at picking up stuff that's not quite right, you know, because all writers, you know, we get stuck and we try to fudge our way through a scene. And, you know, like, I'm stuck here. I don't know what the fuck they're going to say. Here's two more lines and I'm out. And she'll catch it right away. Mm-hmm. And so that she's very, very talented that way. And she's seen a lot of movies, not as many as me. I've seen more movies than Leonard Maltin. But she has a good vocabulary of cinema.
Yeah.
And so that part's all good. And acting, she loves acting, and she's actually a terrific actress. And I'm not just saying that because mm-hmm. she's like 10 feet away and holding a machete, but no, she really is. But you know, we both have, we have, I think what kept us together, I'm chewing Nicorette gum.
Go for it.
What I think kept us together all these years is that besides that, we really love each other. We weren't like mentally ill enough to be hugely successful. We were just like always like successful.
Right.
But, you know, like, I think you have to really be stark raving insane to have superstardom. You have to throw children under buses, you know, set fire to churches. You don't care. It's all about you. And I don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have that. You know, like, life is more important than movies. I love movies. They're one of the great things about life for me. But it's not life itself, you know. I'm blessed that I get to make them, but it's, you know, because I've met some of the most powerful film directors in the world, right? And they're just miserable people, some of them.
Yeah.
Not all of them. But I've met guys that are like, I'm like, what are you miserable about? You're like, you're a billionaire, and you make, well, you know, you make these movies, and they're just like, oh, my movie didn't open, it came in second. I'm like, yeah, it only opened to 63 million. Where's my rope? I'm gonna hang myself.
right.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm just not that guy, you know.
What is the you've been in this business now for, you know, 30 something plus years.
Yeah, dinosaurs were ruling the earth when I first started out. Yes.
Is there any major difference between how movies are made now from when they were made in the 80s? What's the big difference?
I mean, the way they were made, Hollywood itself has changed a great deal. When I first arrived in Hollywood, it was the greatest time on earth to be a screenwriter, in that studios were developing and developing and developing. And there were like, say, 10 executives at a studio.
Mm-hmm.
Each executive probably had 20, 25 projects that they were developing. And you could go to studios and pitch a really good idea and they would buy it and develop it with you. You would lock horns with people, but you know, everyone wanted to do good work. And the most important thing was Hollywood was like ravenous for the original idea,
mm-hmm.
the original screenplay. So I landed here right at exactly the right time in terms of, I had a head full of ideas. Hey, let's do a movie about this. Hey, let's do a movie about that. Well, today, an original screenplay is kryptonite, okay? They don't care. It's got to be based on a thing that was once another thing, that was originally one thing, based on a movie that was based on a short story, that was based on an idea, that was just, you know, that was once a comic book, that was once a thing that a guy heard on the corner. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. And an original screenplay, they're like, huh? You know, I don't know how to sell that. I don't know how to sell them. Like, it's a great idea.
Yeah. I've heard like best case scenario, it gets you a job writing one of those things you're talking about.
Yes.
That's kind of what it is more now.
Yes. People can see that you can write, hopefully.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could never get Midnight Run made today, or even Bad Boys. I mean, I wrote a cop comedy with a partner a couple of years ago. That was a really funny script, you know, and everyone that read it said, this thing's a riot. They're never going to make it. And it's really kind of sad, you know, because yeah. I think there's a tremendous appetite still for that stuff. I mean,
Does
anybody, do you meet anybody in the street that says, boy, the movie sucked 20 years ago, they're so much better today? No. It's like, I mean, they might be highly successful, which is obviously why people make them, I suppose, you know, the financiers. But I don't know, like the superhero stuff, I mean, I watched 10 minutes of it and I like, I've had enough. I mean, okay, he's flying from here to there and, oh, let me guess, he's going to kick his ass. And, you know, like, shit, an explosion. Did he survive? Of course, he's a superhero. It's like, you know, for me, it's a, you know, I don't know, man. It's like, to me, it's like, I don't want to be hated, but it's like movies for like buffoons to me. It's like, what happened to cinema?
Right.
You know, what about like the idea of going to the movies and seeing cinema and going, getting transported to a place you've never been before, you know, be it an American film, a foreign movie. I used to love, I mean, I remember the first time I saw 400 Blows, this Francois Truffaut movie. I was like knocked on my ass. I was like, man, oh man, what a great movie that reminded you of being a child in the way that movie did. And that sort of, you know, being a troubled kid. And where is all that stuff? You know, I don't, yes, there's some good independent movies getting made, but man, you got to scratch and put up your house to make them. I mean, it's, you know, it's funny. I always say this, you know, the B movie of the 50s is now the A movie of today, you know, the creature running around the spaceship, eating all the astronauts. That was the B movie, the C movie, you know, that was the Roger Corman movie.
Yeah.
Now that's the $200 million movie. You want to make a movie about, well, it's about a vet coming home from the war. And you got to put your house up to make that one.
They don't make like the, somebody was saying this. I was reading somewhere. They're talking about how they don't make like the $40 million movie anymore. Like it's either $200 million or it's less, or it's $1 million, right?
Yeah.
It's one or the other. They don't make like the, you know, we don't get like, I mean, this is a random thing to say, but something like in the 90s, we got stuff like Malice and, Jennifer
real
8.
Movies. Yes, Jennifer 8. Yeah, a perfect example.
They're not making those anymore.
No. And it's funny you mentioned Jennifer 8. What an obscure, but that's a beautifully shot movie. Have you seen it recently?
In the last like 5 years, yes.
Yeah, I watched it a couple of months ago and I just was knocked out at how beautifully it was shot.
There
just
was
a gorgeous looking movie.
There was this weird, I didn't know this till later because I didn't really know what a giallo was until I was in my 20s, but there was that weird,
I don't know,
period.
What it is now and I'm 65.
But like the Italian films, like Dario Argento and Mario Bava.
Mario Bava. Oh yeah. My God. Yeah.
There's this weird trend in the early 90s. They made all those American like erotic thrillers and stuff were very reminiscent of the Italian horror films.
If we're going to start talking about Italian horror movies, you remember Cal Tiki, the immortal monster?
I've never seen it. I know what you're talking about.
I've never seen that
either. Man, I had nightmares when I was a kid. I saw it recently. I couldn't stop laughing. I can't believe, you know, but it was some weird blob that would, like, if it got on you, it hit all your flesh, and then it got on this guy's face and ripped part of his face off. You know, there's some really, truly gruesome, horrible things in that movie still. I don't know quite how they did it. I mean, I'm pretty good at figuring stuff out now, you know, but I mean, I was looking at, how did they do that blob? It was not stop action. It was some sort of thing. I can't believe we're supposed to be talking about Vanquish. I'm talking about fucking
sorry.
Tiki.
Sorry, I didn't mean to get a sidetrack.
Yeah, Mario Bava, you started it. Okay. Let's talk about Ed Wood while we're at it.
Yeah, we could.
Sure, why not? Ed Wood, why not?
I will turn it back to Vanquish though. We talked a little bit about Morgan Freeman and Ruby Rose and everything, but what was your casting like on this movie? How did you come to find some of the actors? Patrick Muldoon, who I hadn't seen in a while.
I'll tell you how I make movies. I did a movie just before this called The Comeback Trail, which is supposed to come out in June. You guys know about this movie?
I saw it listed on your resume, obviously.
Yeah, it's coming out in June. It's been held up now for like a year because of COVID. It was supposed to come out in theaters in November, then they kept changing it. Because I've been doing this forever, I know a lot of people. So I cast a lot of Vanquish the same way I cast Comeback Trail. I had this script for Comeback Trail, I'll give you for instance, and it is a throwback to the kind of movies that we were talking about that don't get made. And if you know anything about the movie, Robert De Niro plays a complete bottom feeding, horrible human being. Of course, he's a movie producer from the 1970s, making like these Mario Bava kind of movies. Okay. And he cannot make a decent movie. And he's so heavily in debt to Morgan Freeman, who plays his financier, who's really like a mob guy. He says, look, the only way I can get out from under is he comes up with this scheme where they're going to heavily insure an actor and try to kill him in a stunt to collect the insurance money. So they put together this fake movie. They go to the old actor's home. They find Tommy Lee Jones, who is a suicidal ex-Western star who hasn't worked in 40 years. When they find him in the room, he's got a gun in his mouth. They're like, oh, he's perfect. He wants to die. So they cook up this insurance scheme to kill him, but then they can't kill him because he starts surviving every horrible stunt they put him through.
So
I wrote the script. I couldn't give it away, and I was like, god damn it, you know. People, did you read it? Yeah. Was it funny? Oh, it was hysterical. Do you want to make it? No, I don't want, nobody's gonna make this. So I was like, all right, damn it, I'm gonna do it myself. So I called up De Niro, who's my buddy from Midnight Run. I said, look, Bob, I know this is not how things are done. We go through the agent, but would you please take a look at this script? He said, yeah, sure. He ready? Called me back 2 days later. He goes, this is hysterical. I said, thank you. Do you want to make it? And he goes, yeah, sure. You want to direct that? I was like, yeah. But boom, suddenly that's how that happened. Then I called Morgan because I knew him, and De Niro knew Tommy Lee Jones very well. So that's how that movie came together. To answer your question on Vanquish, I just picked up the phone. I called Morgan. And I said, look, I got this really interesting script. You want to take a look at it? And he read it and he said, yeah, I'll do it. So then once I had Morgan, then, you know, financing became easy. And then, you know, a few people were suggested. I met with Ruby and I fell in love with her right away. And then you see Patrick Muldoon. Patrick Muldoon is a buddy of my wife. And Patrick Muldoon was also an exec producer on Comeback Trail.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's how I met Patrick. And right away we became friends. And he's just a hoot. He's a great guy. He's funny as hell. He gets the drill. You know, he gets the joke. Don't take it too seriously. You know?
Yeah.
It's just a movie.
He will always be the man that broke up Kelly Kapowski and Zach Morris on Saved by the Bell in my life.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yes. He has to live that for the rest of his days. Plus, he's the guy that gets his brain sucked out by that freaking bug in
Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers, yeah.
And I have to tell you, now that I know him so well, and he's really my friend, I talk to him like every other day, I can't watch that scene anymore. I used to think it's hysterical. But I'm like, that's my friend is getting his brain sucked out. I don't know if I want to watch that, you know.
So you said crazy, though. You've got a movie coming out with Morgan Freeman, Tommy Lee Jones and Robert De Niro that, I mean, that should be, even in 2021, that should be a wide release. Like that should be.
It's going to be a wide release.
Oh, great,
yeah,
great.
Yeah, third week of June. Yeah, I think it's like 2,000 screens, something like
that. Oh, awesome. That'll be good. Yeah.
And if it does well, they're going to expand. So.
And we should actually be back in theaters by then. So that'll be great.
I hope so. Tell your friends, The Comeback Trail.
Awesome.
It's a complete, it's just utter silliness for like 100 minutes. It really,
I love that type of stuff, man. I can't wait to see it. Yeah,
I do too. And I think it's like especially needed now. I mean, You know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, there's stuff in there, like there's like Three Stooges jokes. Like there's a horse that goes batshit crazy every time and there's the word rhubarb. It just starts going nuts. I mean, there's really stupid shit in there, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know, it's funny. Like, I think like sometimes like, you know, maybe, you know, I could have been an Academy Award winning filmmaker, but I just find farts too funny.
It's right,
like,
right.
I can't help it. Farting is funny, you know? There goes my Oscar, you know.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you should have got a best screenplay for Midnight Run. I don't, you know.
I heard I missed the nomination by a few votes.
Oh,
somebody,
my God.
Somebody
oh, really?
On the inside told me. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
What even won that? I guess Rain Man, maybe.
Rain Man won. Yeah. And I knew Barry Morrow very well. I say you stole my Oscar.
You said that you learned something new on each movie that you make. What was some things you learned making Vanquish and making Comeback Trail?
Well, you know, the more it's funny. There's a lot of things that it's very funny when you write a screenplay. You have a tendency, and I write pretty streamlined scripts, but there's still that tendency to over-explain things, you know, because you're describing things that you can very easily get in one shot.
Yeah.
And when you start to shoot the script, you start to realize, why was this such a terrific script and why is this movie so slow? Mm-hmm. You know, like what's not right? And it always comes back to that the audience is getting way ahead of your movie. It's like, I understand he's broke. I saw his house.
Yeah.
You know, I saw the outside of it. I knew he was poor. You know, why do you keep telling me he's poor? He's poor. He's poor.
Right.
You know? And because as a writer, if you're also the director, you have to wear two hats a lot and you get very married to things because you put a lot of time into them and you think they're highly important. And then you have to listen to somebody. Yep. As much as it's like the most painful thing in the world to hear, you have to listen to when somebody comes along and says, George, nobody gives a shit, you know? That you spent a month on that. Nobody fucking cares, you know?
Right.
So you've got to listen. You're like, you know, but you have to listen. And there was stuff in, you know, every time you write something, you go, no, I need that. And then you're like, no, I don't need that. So, you know, but you learn that on every movie. On Vanquish, you know, the reason I wanted to do Vanquish so much, because a lot of the, as you may have put together, I'm quite the verbose person. A lot of the movies I've made were dialogue driven. Like Comeback Trail is very dialogue driven. There's definitely stunts in it and antics, but most of the jokes are set up by dialogue, you know? With Vanquish, there's a lot of silences in the movie. You know, you get out of a car, you creep down an alley, you walk through some big warehouse. There's no dialogue for like 3-4 minutes. I wasn't used to doing that, but I wanted to try it because I'll tell you what movie I watched. There's a terrific, terrific movie I watched recently. I forgot how good it was. Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. You remember
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And Michael Cimino, I think that was the first movie he directed. Mm-hmm. Man, that movie played silence is great. You know, it starts out with that church and the wind is blowing and you're looking through the grass and you hear the barely hear the sound of the preacher coming from inside and then a car pulls up and you hear the tires on the gravel. I mean, it really, really built beautifully. And I was like, oh man, I'd love to, that maybe I saw that a year ago and I was like, I'd love to experiment with filmmaking that way.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got a chance to kind of do it a little bit with this. You're telling stories with just images.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one thing. I mean, that was one thing I liked about this. I don't know if this entirely relates, but one thing about this movie that I liked was, you know,
You like just one thing?
Just one thing.
With you guys.
Yeah, exactly. no, there's a point where you see Morgan Freeman's house in this movie, and
I
you're
love
like,
that house, by the way.
Yeah, the house is awesome.
So did I.
I'll
tell you a story about that, but go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, go ahead.
But you see that house and it's like, God, does anybody ever learn any lessons in these movies? Cops cannot afford these houses. And then like 5 minutes later, he's telling Ruby Rose, do you really think that I could afford this house with a cop salary?
Oh yeah, by being a straight cop, yeah. Yeah, without being a criminal.
Right.
Well, I'm glad you caught that because actually That was not in the original script. I put that in the script because there's no way this guy could live in this place.
Right.
He was obviously a criminal, but this is where he's really doing well as a criminal. I'll tell you how that came about, because originally the way it was written, he lived in an old kind of gothic, you know, kind of a stone house, kind of a place that felt damp, you know, inside, and closed curtains and that kind of vibe. And so Joe Lemon, the production designer, said, he called me up and he goes, "You're really going to hate me." I said, "What?" I've done a lot of movies with Joe, you know. He goes, "You're really going to hate me." He goes, "I found a really bitchin' house." He said, "But it's not at all like what you have in the script. And it's owned by one of the wealthiest guys in Mississippi, and he's not in town. And the place is gigantic. It's three stories high. It's all made out of glass." So right away, I thought to myself, oh, shit. The whole movie takes place at night. The only saving grace was that I could shoot maybe interiors during the day and black out the windows, because I hate working nights.
Yeah.
But he goes, "So I know you're going to hate me because you're going to have to shoot nights because it's all glass. We can't tent this place, you know?" And it's not at all what you wrote. So I says, "All right, I'll take a look." I'm always open to anything. I took a look at it, and there was that enormous dome and gigantic windows. And I'm like, this place is ridiculous. I mean, it's, you know... So I said, "Yeah, we got to shoot here. If the guy really wants to let us shoot here, you know." So yeah, that's what we did. So and then we added that line that you caught, because I said, "We have to make reference to this place because this is nuts."
Yeah, you know, I was so happy that it was addressed. I can't explain it because
cop living in Xanadu, it's like, it's so ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've seen, and obviously, like, Most cop movies don't show them living in places that extravagant, but I've seen movies where people are just cops and they're supposedly honest cops who are living in well beyond their means.
How about house apartments? Look at the original, the Superman that did the Richard Donner Superman. Lois Lane lives in a penthouse. She's a Cub reporter. You know, I mean, she'd be living in a closet, you know?
Yeah.
She wouldn't even be living in Manhattan. She'd be out in Brooklyn somewhere, you know?
I'll tell you, whenever I see a house like that in an action movie, though, I always heard that story that Shane Black in the Lethal Weapon script wrote something like, "It looks like a house that I would buy if this movie makes money."
It's very funny. Shane Black, you know, he's famous for writing those things in scripts. You know, he wrote a love scene that said, "I would describe it, but my mother and father read my screenplay."
You shot that in Mississippi, though. Is that what you said? God, we've had
a popular place lately.
I know. Like, three out of the last four directors we've interviewed have shot their movies in Mississippi, it seems.
Well, they
have
a phenomenal tax credit. It's 35%. That's awesome. So every time you spend a dollar, you're getting back 35 cents. That's hard to turn down. Plus, Morgan Freeman lives in Mississippi.
Oh, yeah.
So, that's nice.
Yeah. So Morgan was like, "I'll do your movie, but I'll definitely do your movie if I can roll out of bed and go to the set." So that's.
We talked to a guy from Ireland that said it was one of the most cinematic places he's ever been. I was like, Mississippi? I was like, okay.
You know, I have to tell you, it's very interesting you said that too, because, you know, like, you know, I didn't, until like the last 4 or 5 years, I didn't know that much about, you know, the South, other than I drove through it a few times. But, you know, like, whatever my visions of the South were, they were definitely like derived from ridiculous movies I've seen, you know. I don't know what I thought it was going to look like, but, you know, I went to Birmingham, Alabama. I did a film called Bigger, and I shot the whole thing in Birmingham, where I doubled New York City, New Jersey. I mean, I could, and a lot of it looks like upstate New York. It's like rolling hills and streams and lots of trees. I thought everything was going to look like it's ridiculous, I admit my ignorance, but I thought everything was going to look like what's the Walter Hill movie? Southern Comfort?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where they're in the swamp. I thought that was the South, you know?
I mean, it's parts of it. It's definitely
parts of it. Yeah,
we're in Nashville, so we're in the heart of the South. But You've been to Mississippi quite a few times.
Yeah.
Nashville was, I got to tell you, a lot of the South is gorgeous. I said to my wife, "Let's move here," you know, because everybody's so nice. And, you know, I'm not, I've been living in L.A. for 37 years, but I've never fully... adopted to the place, you know, in a way, adapted to the place. And my wife is from Orange County. So I don't know. I like quiet. And, you know, I don't know. I'd love to sit on my lawn and see a gator walk by. I think that'd be just great, man. I mean it, you know. I noticed there's a lot of three-legged dogs, though, running around. I guess, did you notice that in Nashville? In the South, I saw a couple three-legged dogs. And
Know if you see as many in the city, but yeah, on the outskirts, yeah.
We don't have much longer.
No, let's do this for another hour. I'm enjoying it.
I know we can talk about this.
Listens to me, except for you two. This is lovely.
I was just wondering what your hardest day on set was.
On this movie?
Yeah.
You have a Southern accent. Are you from Nashville?
Yeah, I'm originally from. I think. Yeah Jonathan, too. You are too.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So.
You guys, I tell you what's pretty is, what's that big park I went to with Julie? Smoky
Centennial?
Mountain National Park.
Smoky Mountain. Yeah.
Man, if I could die, I could live there, boy. That was.
Yeah, we're 3 or 4 hours from that.
Man, that is just stunning.
Yeah,
because I'm a painter too. You know, that was a little,
I ran across that. I did not know that before this.
Yeah, I could get lost in that place.
I bet.
Mm-hmm.
What was my hardest day on Vanquish?
Yeah, what was your hardest day?
I don't know. I don't. They were all. It was all nights. So that's always like challenging. I don't know what was the hardest night, Julie. What was I complaining about the most? Patrick Muldoon, that pain in the ass. No, I'm kidding.
No, just give us the straight dope about Patrick Muldoon. That's what
Patrick
we came
Muldoon,
here for.
A horrible person. No, Patrick is great. I don't know. I mean, they were all pretty grueling. I mean, if you want to hear movie trivia,
yeah.
We shot during the height of COVID. So, you know, I'm dressed up like a beekeeper, you know, directing the movie. I got like the plastic thing and the mask and the gloves and the little things on my feet. And I'm running around trying to talk to actors going, somebody tested positive for COVID while we were shooting. Oh, no. Mm-hmm. So we had to shut down. It ended up being a false positive,
mm-hmm.
but that we lost a couple of days there. And then we got a hurricane hit while we had about 5 days left. And they said we were directly in the path of it. And of course it missed by 200 miles, but they said, if you look at the thing, beep, 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 you know, it was going right to Biloxi.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to pack up and leave. Everybody evacuated. And, I went to Birmingham to visit my friend, Chris Mullinex, who's one of the actors in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he lives in Birmingham. So we stayed with his family. And then of course, I think the thing went to Louisiana, and then we came back and finished the movie. So that part of it was difficult in that, you know, you try to get some kind of momentum making a movie. And then if you have to keep stopping and stopping and stopping, you get back to set like, you know, 6 days later and you're mm-hmm. like, what was I talking about? What were we doing?
Or,
you
know, yeah.
And then the script supervisor goes, you said blah, blah, blah. And you were here and you were there. And you go, yeah, but why did we think that was a good idea 6 days ago?
Right.
You know, so and it's just a lot of stuff like that. You kind of lose your train of thought, but. I mean, I think the movie looks pretty fluid considering we had to stop twice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another amazing thing is like all three of the directors we've talked to who were working in Mississippi had to deal with either monsoons or hurricanes or something like that. It's almost like I don't know if this was happening all at the same time or if it's just a coincidence, but like everybody, it'd be amazing if I could figure out the production dates for all three of these movies and just, and see if you were all shooting at the same time.
Well, there was another crew while we were shooting there because we would see their trucks every once in a while. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't remember what movie that was, but mm-hmm. yeah, but Mississippi, Mississippi's got a lot of production, like we said earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Mississippi, and the mm-hmm. the Gulf is just gorgeous.
Yeah,
right? Absolutely, absolutely.
And people are so nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're so nice. You know, it's like it's look, I'm not putting down LA. I came out here with no money, and you know, I did good. I mean, LA's been kind to me. So I'm not putting down Los Angeles. But it's just a, you know, it's funny, like you could live next door to somebody for 20 years and not know what they look like. You know, I'm not used to that. Like in New York, everybody knew everybody. You knew who your neighbors were, you know. What, honey? Oh, yeah. My wife said it's like living in the witness protection program. It's
like, yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to say hi, but I just can't. although I got to tell you, I did. Can I talk? I'm totally digressing. I definitely met a guy that was in the witness protection program. I forgot where we were, but we were nowhere. And this guy owned a pizzeria. And he can't, and if there was ever a guy from New York, it was this guy. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, he goes, can I get you anything? And I'm like, yeah, how about a slice of pizza? And I said, where are you from? And he went, Phoenix. And I went, Phoenix. I've been to Phoenix. Nobody looks or talks like you from Phoenix. He goes, yeah, well, that's where I'm from. And I was all right, you're from Phoenix. Yeah. Yeah. I'm from Kansas. Yeah. Give me a break.
I could talk all the movies with you, especially since you have just, you probably are almost encyclopedic in a way and how many things you've seen.
Oh yeah. I can do movies. I've got movies memorized.
Oh yeah.
You ever see The In-Laws with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin? I was in the bush for a total of 9 months. I saw things like tzatziki flies the size of eagles. The natives had a name for them, Jose Grecos y Muertos, the flamenco dancers of death. What did you do about the flies? Unfortunately, there was very little we could do because they were covered under the provisions of the Guacamole Act of 1913. Brown babies clutching their beaks. Beaks, flies with beaks. It was a terrible sideshow. Unfortunately, I left the slides in a jacket that got modernized. I'll tell you something, Shelby. Slides would have won me the Pulitzer Prize. I know movies by heart. Yes, I do know my movies.
I had a screenplay writing teacher in college. That was his favorite movie. Was The In-Laws?
The In-Laws?
Yep.
Possibly some of the, I mean, without a doubt, some of the most brilliant, nonstop dialogue.
I agree.
And I'll tell you something, if I might digress for a moment.
Go for it.
I watched it very carefully when I was doing Comeback Trail because Arthur Hiller I knew really well. And Arthur Hiller died, I think, last year. Great guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed The In-Laws, and he directed Silver Streak, and he directed the original Out of Towners. And I really picked his brain when I knew him. I said, Arthur, I said, those movies are hysterical and they're so relaxed. And he said, that's the key. He goes, I never forced anything. I just let it go. I just let it play. It was already ridiculous. It was already absurd. There's very little for me to do except just let it play. And I tried to use that in Comeback Trail because Comeback Trail is just completely absurd. So I didn't want to have a lot of director fingerprints all over it. I just shot it very straight, like one of those movies. So hopefully it worked out.
It's interesting you bring up Silver Streak because when I was rewatching Midnight Run, I felt like there was some elements of Silver Streak in that movie.
Well, sure. I told you only amateurs borrow, professionals sure. steal.
Well, I remember that quote said. Too.
Yeah, I could tell you. There's a great movie called Lonely Are the Brave. Do you remember that movie where Kirk Douglas?
Mm-hmm. I didn't see that one. No,
dude, you have to see it. Mm. It's definitely you definitely need Kleenex for the ending if you're an animal lover. Mm. But it is one of it. When I met Kirk Douglas, not to name drop, but I met Kirk Douglas at a restaurant and I walked up to him and I said, I just have to introduce myself. I'm a writer, blah, blah, blah. And I said, my favorite movie of yours is Lonely Are the Brave. And he said, that's my favorite movie of all the films I've done.
Awesome.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So check it out.
I'll definitely do that.
Yeah. It's a big chase movie through the mountains, basically the whole film, or like 2/3 of the movie, they're trying to chase him and stop him from getting to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the premise of the movie. And he's really of another time. He's like an 1880s cowboy stuck in the 1960s. But he shoots down a helicopter by shooting out the tail rotor. And that's where I got the idea for Midnight Run, where he shoots out the tail rotor. Mm-hmm. And that's when I said to Waylon Green, I said, look, I borrowed a scene from that movie. He goes, first of all, nobody's seen that movie but you and Kirk Douglas. He goes, and number two, he goes, nobody gives a shit, you know?
Right. So, I think we're going to have to end it, unfortunately.
No, I'm a lonely man. Let's do this forever.
Thank you so much for giving us your time, hearing about all these movies. And we don't get a chance to talk to someone who's got a distinguished career like you do so very often. So to be able to talk about like movies that, you know, from the 80s that we grew up on and everything is amazing. So I'm so happy that we got to talk about that.
That's another thing kids today, man, they don't get the luxury of. I tell my daughter this all the time, because I've seen Midnight Run and Wise Guys I don't know how many times, and that's mainly because they were on HBO like constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, late 80s, early 90s. So, you know, and I was preteen or whatever, and just
it's a sad thing. You know, I have to tell you, I know we have to wrap this up, but I'll make it quick. If you are a person that loves movies, if you're a person that wants to make movies, okay, to not know these films, you know, to not know Humphrey Bogart movies, to not know mm-hmm. The Treasure of Sierra Madre, to not know The Maltese Falcon, mm-hmm. you know, to not know these movies is really hurting yourself, you know. It's, as somebody said to me years ago, not knowing something is okay. Not caring that you don't know really is the crime.
Yeah.
You can't be an artist if you don't know who Picasso is or who Monet is or who Jackson Pollock is or who John Constable is. You know, if you mm-hmm. can't be a painter if you don't know the people that came before you. You have mm-hmm. to know these things. And you know, whenever I get jammed up on something, I lean back on what I know. I lean back, what's good storytelling? Then you don't get lost, because what is it? You stand on the shoulders of giants, of all the great people that came before you. It's insane to not know your craft.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Hey, I do want to tell you one quick story, though. Might think less of me after.
No, that's it. I gotta go. No, go ahead.
Well, I just want to tell you, going back to Trapped in Paradise, I'm not saying this because I feel manly or anything. I just, for whatever reason, I don't typically have like emotional reactions to movies. I don't cry a lot in movies, but when they left that horse in Trapped in Paradise, that really got me. You know, I remember, and the girl I was on the date with just looked at me like, seriously, this is what's making you cry?
Oh, good for you, man. That's great. That's good to know. I'll tell you the truth. I felt bad doing it too. I am a softy when it comes to this stuff. Yeah. You know, like I am what I am. It's like in what's the movie they want to ban now? Every movie ever made. Okay. Now what's the movie they want to ban? The one where she Breakfast at Tiffany's, when she throws the cat out the door.
Yeah.
Every time I see them, I'm like, no. And then she picks it up in the rain and she holds it. Every time I see that, I start crying. That's why I tell you about Lonely Are the Brave. If you're an animal lover and with a horse, forget it.
Said that, and I immediately thought of Trapped in Paradise. Like, oh, I got to tell him the story.
Well, the first time
back to stealing from another movie, A Horse on a Highway. You know.
Well, the first time I felt tremendous sadness watching a movie was The Neverending Story, and watching Atreyu's horse go into the swamps of sadness. So, you know, I was not expecting that as a, you know, 7 or 8 year old at the time. But
you know, what's amazing about human beings, and it's like, you could kill a million people in a movie, nobody gives a shit. You harm one dog or a cat, and everyone's outraged and crying. Oh, no, not Fido.
You can
burn down a village, and it's okay. You know?
My mom said, don't kill a kid or an animal, and I'm good.
Yeah.
You can destroy all adults within that range, you know.
The only movie that got killed animals and made it funny that I can remember was Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Killing those dogs.
Yeah.
by accident. That was great.
But even those are sad, especially when you see Michael Palin's reaction to them.
I guess you're laughing at that. It's hard because he was an animal lover, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh God, that makes me want to watch that movie now.
Yeah. So good. And then of course at the very end, after if he finally gets the woman with, you know, and everything, he finally like laughs in front of all those people and everything. It's so brilliant.
Oh, that was 88 too. That's a hell of a year for comedy.
That got nominated.
Yeah.
And I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
I think Klein won, didn't he?
Klein did win, yeah. Yes.
The movie got nominated for best screenplay too.
Okay. The movie is Vanquish. We'd like to thank George Gallo again for coming on. This was amazing. The movie comes out in theaters April 16th, digital on demand April 20th, and Blu-ray on April 27th. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much. And guys, let's do one for Comeback Trail, okay?
Yeah, absolutely,
I definitely want to do that for sure.
All right.
Yeah.
You got it.
That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkins and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.